from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 2012, Donald Trump tweeted that then-President Barack Obama might go to war in order to help his re-election chances. That didn't happen, of course, but it has in the past, says presidential historian Michael Beschloss. In his new book, Presidents of War, Beschloss profiles nine commanders-in-chief and finds that some indeed have entered war to make themselves more powerful and popular.
And my worry is, with a modern president, and Donald Trump is president, that he may be tempted at some point to lurch toward war because he knows that that can help a president who has an election ahead of him.
Michael Beschloss joins us to talk about the monumental decisions of wartime presidents and what they've struggled with. That's coming up after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, Presidents of War, Michael Beschloss writes about nine commanders-in-chief who have faced the heavy burden of war. But as much as he describes the mental and physical toll war takes on individual presidents, he also writes that wars are increasingly being entered into at the behest of the president, not Congress. The book examines the complex decisions wartime presidents have struggled with throughout history, from the War of 1812 to the present day, and whether going to war is still subject to the will of the American people. Michael Beschloss has authored nine books on presidential history and has been called the nation's leading presidential historian by Newsweek, and he joins us for this Forum Hour. Welcome, Michael Beschloss.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm good and delighted to have you here. I was saying to...
Thank you. I am too.
Saying to one of my producers, boy, it's been so long, at least a decade since we've had Beschloss on, and then I realized you've been writing this book for the last 10 years.
Right. It took 10 years. I'm sorry.
Nothing to be apologizing for.
Would have loved to get it. It really needed to take that long, as it turns out.
Well, you're covering almost two centuries and nine presidents.
Right.
It's a lot of territory, and the book has really much to recommend it. It's a lot of narrative force that really... is compelling. And before I go on praising, let's go to the actual thesis of the book, which I think I just addressed. That is the increasing sense of more and more power for presidents when it comes to war. I guess the key point really was Truman.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, as you know, in the Constitution, the founders wanted to make sure that presidents did not become dictators. And they felt that the way that people in Europe, kings and the monarchs of Europe, took power illicitly, most of all, was when they got to be unpopular, they would come up with some reason to go to war. The country would go to war, the nation would be united, and once again, the king was popular again. And so the founders, as you know, were trying really hard to make sure that presidents never got too much power. So you look at the Constitution, if a president wants a war, what the Constitution says is that Congress has to be the ones to declare it. But as history moved on, more and more presidents took that power for themselves. And you're absolutely right, Michael. The moment that was really key was Harry Truman in June of 1950. The North Koreans invaded the South. Truman said, okay, we Americans have to respond with force. And his advisors said, you know, if you've got a major war in mind, Mr. President, you've got to go to Congress and ask for a war declaration, the same way that James Madison did, and all these presidents all the way up to FDR in 1941 and 1942. And Truman, to his great discredit, says, I don't want to do it because I'm worried that there will be a big acrimonious debate. I've got midterm elections about 5 months from now. Does this sound familiar, Michael? And I don't want to have all sorts of things said on Capitol Hill in the course of this debate that might be damaging to me and my administration. So instead, he sent the soldiers to Korea on his own, did not go to Congress. And a couple months later, he was at a press conference and someone said, you know, you are thinking about this, you know, this conflict in Korea. And by then the troops were fighting. You think of this sort of like a police action under the United Nations, right? And Truman said, exactly, that's exactly what it is. So thenceforth, he said this was done under the United Nations. But the problem with this, Michael, is that if a president takes a shortcut like that, and it was a violation of the Constitution, it's a bad example for other people. And guess what happened 14 years later?
No, it was a bad precedent. I'm sorry, Lyndon Johnson, you were going to say, gave us Tonkin Bay in Vietnam.
That's it. You know, there's a Johnson says claims there's an unprovoked attack in the Gulf of Tonkin off of Vietnam, which there was not. And he goes to Congress and he gets a resolution authorizing him to use force. And people say, why don't you ask for a war declaration? He says, I don't have to. Truman didn't ask for one.
Well, it goes back also to Madison in the beginning, in the War of 1812, when Washington, D.C. was set aflame by the Brits. And there are wonderful details in your book. I didn't know that Madison was all of 5'4", or that he was actually given laudatory remarks by a slave for not whipping slaves. You managed to embed those in your narratives in ways that are really
right.
very engaging. But Jefferson avoided that 1812 war with the Brits. It was all over naval, as many historian buffs know. But Madison took us in there, even though he had been a strong advocate of, well, the executive not taking that monarchical
power. Yeah, I was terribly hypocritical of Madison. He was a great founder. He was a terrible war president. And in 1812, the war hawks in Congress were saying, we need a war against the Brits because they're harassing our ships. And also, why don't we have a war in which we grab Canada and make it part of the United States? So Madison thought this was a great idea. He also thought it'd be nice to be a war president. He didn't have a big war record. And he actually bought a uniform with a sword which dangled at his side, bicorn hat with a feather. He sort of enjoyed that. So he went to Congress and he said, I think we need a war with Britain. The problem is, almost half the country was against the idea, and almost half the Congress was. And the idea of our founders was that you don't go to war unless it's absolutely essential for our security and unless the nation supports it. And I guess what I would say, Michael, is number one, what was the most unpopular war in American history? It was not Vietnam. It was the War of 1812. And number two, what was the first war that we lost in American history? It was not Vietnam. It was the War of 1812, although most people don't know that.
And that war didn't have to be fought because the Brits had started to back away and essentially had reversed in many ways, hadn't they?
Totally unnecessary. It was almost like the war, the weapons of mass destruction at the time of Iraq and Afghanistan. The Brits actually stopped harassing our ships, and we didn't need to fight the war, but Madison was enjoying so much, he proceeded, and he goes ahead with this war that, ironically enough, because of things like the Star-Spangled Banner and Don't Give Up the Ship and Andrew Jackson at New Orleans, people tend to remember, those who remember 1812 at all, as a big victory, which it wasn't.
But you've just touched on two important motifs in your book. And we're talking, by the way, with Michael Beschloss. His new book is called Presidents of War. And I'm speaking directly to the lying that would go on and the usurpation of the Constitution.
You're
but I'm
so
even,
right.
Also speaking about the fact that we have a lot of expansionism, and especially a lot of those early wars, lying, as we said, about Tonkin Bay, and lying also James Knox Polk in terms of the Mexican-American War and about the Maine, the famous Spanish-American War, but also that sense of wanting manifest destiny to move forward, and the president, again, usurping power to a great degree because of that.
Yeah, and lying all the while. You're absolutely right. James Polk, you know, in 1846, he comes up with this fake incident on the Texas border provoking the Mexicans so that there's a little clash so that Polk then can go to Congress and say, we've been attacked by Mexico, we need a war, which he said. And Congress complied. And so he fought a major war, went all the way to Mexico City. It took 2 years. And his purpose, we now know for sure because his diaries were later opened, and he talks about, today I lied to Congress, you know, and he says this boastfully. His real purpose was not retaliating against Mexico for a border incident. In fact, he had in mind to get nearly a million square miles of new territory from Mexico and make it part of the United States, including all the way up to San Francisco.
When I read your work, I come up with the notion that really the only two wars, to some extent, that you see as truly justifiable were the Second World War under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Civil War under Abraham Lincoln. But I can't help thinking also points that you make, that is, that the Civil War actually had Lincoln suspending habeas corpus, and World War II essentially had the internment of the Japanese.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so fascinating to write about these, you know, really these only nine or ten people in the history of the United States have had the experience of sending large numbers of Americans off to die and starting a major war. So what I was trying to do is understand this from inside their heads and what they were doing behind the scenes. what was different about them? What was different about this experience of starting major wars from what, you know, the way the rest of us live? And that's absolutely right, because presidents are, as you know, and we've talked about this before, you know, they are good and bad, like all of us, maybe just writ large. And in Lincoln's case, he did suspend habeas corpus. He did other things that were dictatorial. But two things are somewhat exculpating, at least in my view, and I admire Lincoln so much. Number one was, he said, I'm doing these things. I know that they're a violation of the Constitution. I'm not claiming otherwise. And it's because this nation is in danger of going down because it's gotten divided. And I am only doing this in this moment of national emergency. I don't want anyone else later to emulate it. And the other thing is that I looked at Lincoln really closely. I can't find a minute, Michael, in which he was doing this because of lust for personal power that he wanted to gain for himself.
Well, he suffered, in fact. He suffered a great deal.
Totally suffered. He had enormous empathy. This is someone who ran this war in a way that I would like these other war presidents to have done so. For instance, when there were so many people being killed as a result of his decisions, his people said, we've got to build a new national ceremony cemetery. Where do you want it? And he said, I want it built near my summer house so that every time I go there and come back, I'm going to see the fresh graves being dug of men who were killed because of my decisions. It's going to be painful for me, but I never want to be disconnected from those decisions. And he also said to one of his friends, can you imagine that I, who cannot even stand to watch a chicken being slaughtered, I am responsible for oceans of blood. A lot of our other presidents who ran major wars were a lot more cold-blooded.
And it brings us perhaps to the present. This is a president who has compared himself to Abraham Lincoln. You're one of our most preeminent presidential historians. How do you respond to that kind of rhetoric?
I think maybe that's not the most germane comparison I've ever heard between Donald Trump and Abraham Lincoln. And what I'm worried about, you remember about a minute ago I was talking about lust for personal power? If you are a president who wants more power and more power and to help yourself politically, and if you are unscrupulous, war is one of the quickest ways to do that, because if you look at the history of these presidents waging war, there are all these moments in which they violated civil liberties and they took shortcuts and they cut corners and they did things to make themselves more authoritarian. You were talking about Lincoln, but Woodrow Wilson during World War I came up with something called the Espionage Act, which was You could arrest reporters and go after them for writing things against the president who is running a war. And Donald Trump to this day is using this to harass reporters and track down leaks. FDR abused what was then called the Bureau of Internal Revenue, and the FBI used that to go against people who were critical of the way he was doing things. So did LBJ. Presidents in wartime nowadays, they can declare martial law. You saw something called, did you get on your iPhone, Michael, a couple weeks ago, something called the presidential alert?
I did.
Well, maybe it's used for benign reasons right now, but let's say there's a war and there's a national emergency and Donald Trump or some other modern president is trying to make himself as powerful as possible. He can send you messages exalting himself and giving you orders, conceivably, using exactly that same mechanism. You know, our liberties are always in danger, but they are most in danger when you've got a president in a war.
And you also have a president who, in fact, we played a cut of yours where you were talking about how he had said at one point Obama's going to lead us into war in Iran. President Obama's going to do that because it will ensure his being reelected. And he really kind of laid out the fact that he saw the presidential power as a way of indeed not only conducting a war, leading a war, leading us into war, but also helping boost the election likely. In fact, it was true about Madison, as you said earlier, going all the way back. So this is of concern.
Which is really scary that those two ideas are in Donald Trump's head, that war helps you politically. And he has also said, I notice, he said, that the great presidents in history are those who have waged war. Not the greatest idea to be in his head at this moment.
Of course, historians have often validated that, haven't they? I mean, there's been this sense that Roosevelt and Lincoln were great presidents because they led us through these terrible ravages of war.
That is true, but what I'm worried about is a president who has the capability of doing war-like things, may even be doing those right now, feeling that two rewards for that could be, number one, you help yourself politically, winning an election, elevating your poll ratings, and also you might be well rewarded by history. It's not wrong, but I'd rather not have that in his brain right now.
Well, you also are facing, many of us as citizens of this country, the concern about someone like President Trump with his hands on the nuclear weapons. But there's a time that you write about where tactical use of nuclear weapons was actually advanced.
Yeah, that was one of the scoops in the book. In early 1968, LBJ was waging the war in Vietnam, which he did mostly badly, made terribly terrible mistakes, but he did do one good deed, it turns out, from these documents I got that were just declassified. And that is, in January of 1968, his commander, William Westmoreland in Vietnam, said, "Why don't we avert a defeat in Vietnam by considering the use of tactical nuclear weapons or maybe chemical warfare and move nuclear weapons to Vietnam right now?" And this got to Johnson, and Johnson said, "We're not going to do that. You know, that's the last thing on earth I want, is this war that's going so badly now going nuclear." And Johnson was so adamant about it, he said, "Lock up all the documents that show what Westmoreland has asked. Put them in a safe. I don't want some general learning about this and saying I'm avoiding a way of ending the Vietnam War in victory." And they were locked up and kept from public view for decades, which is one reason why I was able to see them later on. And that, by the way, Michael, is, you know, sometimes people say it doesn't matter who is president. I hope that no one who has lived through the last 2 years of our history would say that it doesn't matter who is president. But in case there is one person listening who still thinks that that might be true, you need someone with that kind of wisdom and understanding that if a general is beginning to talk about nuclear weapons in a war that's totally peripheral to our security, as Vietnam was, civil war in an agricultural country, you need a president with Johnson's firmness who will shut that down.
What are your thoughts, though, Michael, about the sense of, particularly in recent vintage, presidents have had very little experience, obviously Eisenhower being an exception, with anything in the realm of the military or even service to this country in the military, particularly recent presidents like Clinton and Obama and now Trump?
That is something that is a development that's more, it's even more true generally in our society. For instance, if you walk down the streets of Washington, D.C. 50 or 60 years ago, you would see a lot of people in uniform. Now that's no longer true. That would have also been true in San Francisco, even in peacetime. That's what's happening to our society. And now with Donald Trump, we've got the first president in all of our history, 200 years, who has had no governmental experience, no military experience. And if, God forbid, we have a national emergency that threatens war, we're going to be in a big national lab experiment because we cannot predict what's going to happen.
And by the way, we should mention it was General Westmoreland who recommended the use of nukes when Johnson was president. We're talking with Michael Beschloss, presidential historian and author of the new book, Presidents of War. He appears Thursday at noon at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco and at 7 p.m. at Dominican University in San Rafael with book passage. And what about the argument that, well, presidents aren't declaring war? And in fact, one thinks about, in conjunction with smaller wars, Obama's intervention in Libya or Trump's bombing of Syria, for that matter. But the purse strings are still Congress's.
It's not enough. I mean, the whole idea of the Constitution was that if you have to go to Congress for a war declaration, there's a debate. A president has to say, this is how long I think this is going to last. This is how many lives are going to be lost. This is the strategy I'm going to use. And also, Congress has signed on to it. The problem, if it's just a resolution, and that's what presidents have weaselly done since 1942. 42 was the last war declaration. Resolutions were used by LBJ in 64, George H.W. Bush for the Gulf War, George W. Bush for Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem there, and we've seen it, is that senators, for instance, who vote for a resolution can say, well, that was just a resolution to use force if necessary. I had never had in mind it would be a real war. The whole point of this is that the best war presidents in history have been those who have ruthless criticism from members of Congress, and also this kind of a debate. We've lost that.
Well, we go back to Madison for a moment because his predecessor, Thomas Jefferson, managed to avoid that war with England. And you could make the argument, I think you do, that every war is a presidential war and has been since Madison.
And that's what it has become. And the problem here is that presidents oftentimes, you know, do this for fake reasons. You know, you were talking about Polk and the fake incident in Texas. 1898, William McKinley, a ship is sunk in Havana Harbor, the Maine, and McKinley says we've got to have a big war against Spain, largely in revenge for the sinking of our ship. Turns out the ship wasn't sunk by Spain. It was sunk by a boiler accident, yet McKinley exploited that for a war that made the United States a world power. You can argue round or flat whether it was a good idea for us to take the Philippines and Guam and Puerto Rico and change the regime in Cuba and become a world power for the first time, but that's what history is. It's ends versus means. You know, I like the fact that San Francisco is part of the United States and not part of Mexico. So the reason that happened was Polk's War. Problem is, Polk's War was based on a lie that was a very bad model for later presidents. Problem here is that, you know, let's say the Gulf of Tonkin of 1964 resolution leading to that big war in Vietnam, let's say that the war in Vietnam ended in victory in 1966, we would probably be looking at Lyndon Johnson in certain ways as a model war president, which should not be the case.
We're talking with Michael Beschloss, one of the nation's leading and most preeminent historians, American history and presidential history. And if you'd like to join us, let me tell you how you can do that. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Michael Beschloss' latest book is called Presidents of War, The Epic Story from 1807 to Modern Times. And what are we to make of the fact that all these presidents, for the most part, had very strong wives?
It's really interesting. I think what we should do is thank God that they did. I mean, let's start with the last one, Lyndon Johnson. I got to know Lady Bird Johnson very well when, you remember, and we've talked about them, I did these two volumes on LBJ's secret tapes, and she only died in 2007, and she very nicely gave me her diaries, for instance. She knew that her husband was, I hate to say bipolar because I'm not trained to make such a diagnosis, but he showed all the signs, and she tried to keep him down when he got too excited, tried to pull him up when he went through these really crippling depressions, helped him to function.
When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Again, please feel free to join the program by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. Our guest, Michael Beschloss, author of a new book called Presidents of War. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with famed historian Michael Beschloss, the author of a new book called Presidents of War, The Epic Story from 1807 to Modern Times, and he'll be appearing this Thursday at noon at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco, and 7 p.m. Thursday at Dominican University with Book Passage. And we're going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I just want to get back to Madison for a moment with you, Michael, because there's something else paradigmatic about, I mean, you begin with him, and this is the first major war after the War for Independence. The hypocrisy of, you know, his saying before he held executive power that war was the true nurse of executive aggrandizement, and then after he faced Henry Clay and all those war hawks and was looking at things politically and so forth, there was a change, even though, as we said earlier, the war was with Britain was completely avoidable. Let's talk just for a moment about the difference between, say, presidential candidates and once they occupy the office and once they become really familiar with the power that that office has.
Well, what you hope is that it helps them to grow, that they develop, especially because, as you rightly said, we are electing presidents with less and less experience. And I think, you know, the eight or nine people that I'm writing about here, you do see growth in most cases, except for the case that a number of them have these emotional breakdowns. LBJ is a perfect example of this. As the war went on, and I listened to more and more tapes that I had not listened to before, and he gets very paranoid. He's very suspicious. He is buying into rumors that are not true. He is full of hatred for Robert Kennedy and for his what he saw as his enemies, you know, protesters on the campuses against his war. And you see him, for instance, saying to Lady Bird, you know, there are Chinese communists who are stuffing cash into the pockets of Bill Fulbright, you know, the Democratic senator, head of the Foreign Relations Committee, was against the Vietnam War. Or Mike Mansfield, who was the Senate Majority Leader, you know, these people in Congress who were against his war. He couldn't accept that they were against his war because out of conviction it had to be that they were being paid off by someone, or maybe they were being blackmailed by someone. And you were talking a moment, Michael, quite rightly, about the strong women who were married to these presidents, for the most part, and I tried to do a lot on them in this book. And Lady Bird said to Lyndon, you know, those FBI files are full of information that's not verified. You shouldn't take it so seriously. One thing she said was that she was astounded by the fact that her husband, during this war, who had not been particularly religious, got more and more religious. His daughter, Lucy, had become a Catholic, and he went with her to Catholic Mass. And by the end of his time in office, Lady Bird told me, I wouldn't have been a bit surprised at that time if Lincoln had converted to Catholicism.
Well, a number of these presidents, actually, of the nine you write about, seem to get more religion as they get more
almost
deep
all
into the wars.
Do.
Yeah, but I'm also struck, reason I also was talking about before assuming presidential power and then getting into the Oval Office was because, well, I mean, take Johnson again as an example. He really was very influenced by what David Halberstam appropriately called at the time, with some irony, the best and the brightest. These were mainly the Eastern Seaboard intellectuals who were advisors to JFK, who got us into the war to a much greater degree. And Johnson was tremendously influenced by them, was he not?
He was, and the biggest villain of all, from my point of view, was Robert McNamara.
I'm with you on that.
Secretary.
Yeah. It was one of the toughest interviews I ever had to do was when I started here 25 years ago and interviewed Robert McNamara. Yeah,
I would have had a hard time restraining myself. One of the worst moments in American history is on one of these Johnson tapes, February of 1965. It's the same month, as you know, that Johnson was sending huge numbers of Americans for the first time, young idealistic kids, off to die in Vietnam. And in public, he was saying, we're going to win this war. You know, I'm full of optimism. So in private, he's talking to McNamara, and he says to McNamara, I can't think of anything worse than losing the Vietnam War, and I do not see any way that I can win. This is 1965. I can't think of many things worse, Michael, that a president can do than to send young Americans off to die, telling them that he expects to win the war. At the same time, in private, he's saying that he thinks that the war is a loser from the very beginning.
I have no words. Let me go to our callers. Bill, you're first up here. Good morning.
Following on, I really appreciate this conversation about the Vietnam War in particular. And I'm wondering if Michael Beschloss, if you wouldn't mind, a little more detail on the Gulf of Tonkin incident, because
sure,
it sort of has become the false flag of all false flags.
Absolutely.
And as you mentioned, we were, of course, already at war. It was a bit of more of a secret war at the time. And so I wonder if you could just go into a little more detail based on your research of what actually took place. What exactly
did President Johnson
do with that?
And we can find, because he taped the whole thing, so you can hear his calls, and I've got quotes from these calls in the book. What happened was that on the 4th of August, he got word that there was an attack against an American ship, but the report was ambiguous. Nonetheless, he was in the middle of a presidential campaign against Barry Goldwater, who was calling him too soft. So he goes on TV that evening and says, I'm bombing North Vietnam in retaliation for this so-called unprovoked attack. A, it was not unprovoked, as you know, and B, he wasn't even sure it was an attack. So goes to Congress, gets this Gulf of Tonkin resolution from both houses almost unanimously, authorizes him to use force. LBJ and Nixon use that resolution as their sole justification to wage the entire Vietnam War for the next decade. Very quickly, Johnson, in private, is told that there was no attack after all in the Gulf of Tonkin. Maybe it was just sort of radar noise or something like this. And despite that, he never went back to Congress and said, you know, in good faith, we were wrong, you know, take back the resolution because it's based on something that never happened. So the result is that one of the great catastrophes of American history was based on basically a lie. And one of the other scoops that I've got in the book is that in 1968, William Fulbright, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and his colleagues were talking about impeaching Lyndon Johnson for exactly that lie. That was in a document opened not terribly long ago. And the problem here is, you know, it's not only a violation of the Constitution for a president to do that with Congress, it creates doubt about everything else. How many times, for instance, have you heard people say, Franklin Roosevelt must have invented the Pearl Harbor attack to get us involved in a war that Americans otherwise would not support? Or, when I first went to Ground Zero in New York after 9/11, I heard a group chanting, 9/11 was an inside job, they were saying. I don't believe either of those things, but it casts doubt on everything a president does, everything a Congress does, and casts doubt on all, our whole democratic system.
And what about, since we're talking about lying, a president who seems often incapable of speaking the truth? I mean, you know, the reality is that is now who's in charge and has the executive office. I mean, even just recently, so it may seem trivial in a way, but when Elizabeth Warren decided to take up President Trump's throwing down the gauntlet and saying, if you take a DNA test and prove you have any indigenous or Native American blood, right, I will put $1 million in your favorite charity. Now he denies he ever even made that statement. I mean, there are things on tape, like, you know, grab him by the whatever, that he now says was a doctor tape and so forth. So you have a president who is, you know, prevaricating all the time. What do you...
He lies hour after hour after hour, and we know that he wants as much power as he can possibly get. We know that he will do almost anything for politics. So given what I've said about war, Michael, the arrows begin to point to a huge temptation by this president to do things that may lead us into a major war that is not necessary. I am extremely worried.
Are you also worried about Kavanaugh becoming a justice because he's a great believer in executive power?
That's exactly it. Kavanaugh wrote an article, as you know, 2009, Minnesota Law Review, saying that presidents perhaps should not be subpoenaed, should not be investigated, should not be indicted, and they can use pardons in lavish ways. Whatever else you think about Brett Kavanaugh, he's got the most extreme fringe views of being permissive about powerful presidents of almost anyone who was on Trump's list. So why do you think he chose him? We now have a justice on the Supreme Court, the deciding fifth vote of that conservative majority, who not only has those views, you know, let a president do almost anything he wants, but also during the last couple of weeks before his confirmation, he became, you know, very indebted and very much, you know, bonded to Donald Trump and his people. They were devising strategies to get him through the confirmation. Donald Trump is not very shy about making people indebted to him. When Neil Gorsuch, his previous nominee, was going before the Senate and said something faintly critical of Trump, Trump said in public, you know, I can rescind these nominations too. And the other thing that really is very worrisome to me is that we know that Kavanaugh was at the White House, you know, plotting this confirmation strategy. Well, one of the things that they do is they say, tell us your most potentially damaging personal secrets so that we can be prepared for them in case they come out and you have to deal with it. I am not exactly sanguine about the prospect of Donald Trump possibly knowing Brett Kavanaugh's most damaging personal secrets and the prospect that in the pretty near future, Brett Kavanaugh could be the deciding vote on a case that determines whether, you know, Donald Trump continues in the presidency or can use presidential power potentially in a way that's almost dictatorial. That makes me very nervous.
Let me bring some more callers on. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering about the War Powers Act and why that can't be used to rein in a president's ability to declare war on a personal basis.
It it was a noble attempt at the end of Vietnam, but didn't really work. This is 73-74, the War Powers Act, that basically says that a president can send in troops, but has to justify it within a period of time, a number of weeks, and if he doesn't do it, he has to withdraw the troops. A lot of damage can be done in that period of time, and I don't think it really ultimately reigns in a president. And also, it's sort of a confession that the Congress is perfectly fine with the Constitution being violated, because the Constitution doesn't say anything about that. It says, you want a major war, you've got to come to Congress.
Let me thank Frank for his call and move on to
me
another
too.
Caller. Let's go to Hannah next. Hannah, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you for this program. And my question is, there are so many similarities between the Vietnam War and the Iraq War. They were based on a lie, and you see some tendencies from the Trump administration to get in war with Iran. So what is it, in your opinion, about some of our presidents, about wanting to have a war, even though they know that the reason for the war might be a lie? Is it the military lobbying, and what can normal people do to help the situation? Basically?
That's a very important question, Hannah, and I thank you for it. I mean, you recall, I know, Michael, during the war in Iraq, the lead up to the war in Iraq, there were citizens protesting, saying weapons of mass destruction don't exist, this is a lie, and so forth, but it didn't keep us from the floodgates of war.
And they turned out to be true. And maybe if there had been a real debate in Congress, it might have explored how shaky the evidence of weapons of mass destruction really was. And, you know, remember I was talking earlier about some of the worst things a president can do? If a president knows that the reason for war is not true, and I think the evidence is still out on George W. Bush one way or the other, but if you have a Polk, for instance, or if you have an LBJ who knows that the reason for war is a lie and yet goes ahead, then you've got family members of dead American soldiers. You know, for instance, because I've written so much on LBJ, I can't tell you, Michael, how many people I've run into. It's heartbreaking who say, you know, you've studied Johnson, you studied the Vietnam War. Please tell me that my family member who died in Vietnam did not die in vain. And what do I say?
60,000 people probably died in vain.
That's yeah. Exactly right. But how can I possibly say that to someone? It's the truth.
Well, I think it comes down, at least in terms of kind of a polemic, I use that word advisedly, but essentially an argument that the only reasons we should go to war are out of absolute necessity and out of the support of Congress and the public.
Yeah, that's my view, and it has to be sort of a last resort. And I'm really worried if you have a president who sees this as the road to political popularity, as the road to, you know, potentially almost authoritarian power, you know, presidents who are waging war, you know, declaring martial law, for instance. That's part of a lot of war plans, and using that presidential alert announcement that we talked about a few moments ago. That could be an enormous temptation. And again, I am not predicting it with Donald Trump, but I am saying it's inevitable that he's going to be tempted. You know, let's say 6 months from now, he's in trouble with Robert Mueller and his numbers are falling and he's looking to possibly running for re-election in 2020. And he remembers that war is a shortcut that can bring you a lot of dividends in your own power and also politically. I'm a little nervous about what kind of a decision he might make.
Here's John. John, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you both for all your good work. I want to provide some major pushback for my
Please
hero,
do.
Harry Truman, who,
okay.
by the way, integrated...
My hero, too, by the way. That's why I'm so disappointed in this one.
Okay, I want to touch on that, please.
Okay.
Harry... integrated the armed forces when it was not a popular thing to do. Secondly,
I can list you 10 great things that Truman did, but it doesn't mean that he didn't do this bad.
Okay, but we're going to get now to the Korean War. If Harry Truman went to the United Nations to get approval to stop the undeniable mass aggression by North Korea against South Korea.
All totally true.
Michael, give me a second. If Lyndon Johnson had done that, if George Bush had done that, we would not have had a war in Vietnam or a war in Iraq. So Harry Truman does not deserve to be put in the same category as those ne'er-do-wells.
Well, A, George W. Bush did go to the United Nations sending Colin Powell with evidence that turned out later to be false. So UN doesn't necessarily get Truman off, at least away from my criticism. And the other thing is that, you know, in Truman's case, and I agree with you, he's my hero too, but he did something that was sort of cheap and political, and he shouldn't have done it from my point of view.
Let me thank you for the call, John, and go to some comments that are coming in. John defending Truman, Joseph attacking Lincoln. Here's what Joseph says. I consider Lincoln a war criminal who led a conflict that killed the largest percentage of Americans of any war, and at what cost would a civil war not have been worth it?
There are some people who have this point of view, which I do not share. Lincoln felt that part of fulfilling his oath was making sure that states did not secede from the Union, which he felt was illegal under the Constitution. He had sworn an oath to defend that Constitution. But one thing that I admire so much in Lincoln, and I think it's important about a war president, and that is for about the first year, Lincoln tried to say, this isn't a war about slavery, I'm just, you know, trying to fulfill the Constitution by bringing North and South back together, almost like the lawyer he was. And to his great credit, within a year or two, he realized that that was not working, and also, you know, he felt ashamed of himself not telling what he really thought. So he began talking about the fact that, all right, yes, we're fighting to reunite North and South, but this is a moral war against the evil of slavery. And once he began talking about the morality of what his side was trying to do, it gave the North a burst of energy that helped it militarily, and I think his ideas helped to win the war. The same thing with Franklin Roosevelt, who was a quick learner. In January of 1941, just before World War II, when he was talking about the conflict that was about to enmesh the United States in World War II, he didn't say, well, this is a balance of power and we have to get in to restore the balance between all these countries. He said, this is a war, this is a crusade, this is a struggle for the four freedoms, which lifted it to a moral plane. And that is, from my point of view, presidential war leadership at its best.
Well, we're talking about presidential morality, and we're really talking about also American values.
Sure.
I'd like to get your thoughts on what is happening right up to the moment here, and that is the President of the United States having an opportunity to take some strong action against the Saudis, which in many people's mind seems unlikely because of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi Turkey, and actually in the embassy in Turkey, the Saudi embassy. There are many who are saying if we let this slide or give it slack or whatever, it's going to mean just about any country can take that kind of license and get a kind of imprimatur from the President of the United States.
That's exactly right. It's made me completely horrified to see the President of the United States saying we can't criticize the Saudis because we might jeopardize an arms deal. And the so-called arms deal is of a size that he exaggerated in talking about it, but it doesn't matter what size it was. Can you imagine our best presidents saying that we cannot criticize the killing of a reporter because we're worried about jeopardizing an arms deal? It's almost obscene. And it's a departure from earlier presidents of both parties.
Well, we got all kinds of new normals now, don't we? I mean, as a presidential historian, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the problem, because Donald Trump is breaking almost every standard, every tradition that presidents have observed in the past. And unless the rest of us who remember these things remind people how serious this is and how much this could begin to dismantle our democracy, we could be in dire shape.
Here's a tweet from Nick who says, doesn't the inception of the Vietnam War belong, and I guess I touched on this before, to JFK, who didn't want to lose Southeast Asia to the Chinese? Could you confirm that, Michael, from your perspective?
Sure. When JFK died, there were about 16,000 advisors in Vietnam. That's a little bit different from over 500,000 troops, which LBJ had in Vietnam in 1968. So, yes, Kennedy did send, actually Eisenhower was the first to send American military men, a few women, to Vietnam in the late 1950s, but LBJ was the one who took this to the extreme and escalated this into one of the big major wars of American history. And let's say, you know, I was talking earlier, let's say it had gone nuclear and enmeshed the Russians and the Chinese and nuclear war had come, and let's say 60 million people were killed, because that's what would have happened if you had had a nuclear war involving Russia and China in 1968, the incineration of part of the Northern Hemisphere. Looking back at this historically, was this civil war in Vietnam worth that? I don't think so.
There's a question from a listener named Eric who says, what is the difference between declaring war and the current authorization for use of military force in Iraq and Afghanistan? Does the distinction change the debate in Congress and in the Oval Office?
Sure it does, because the authorization is a weaselly way for presidents to get out of asking Congress for a real declaration. And it's also a weaselly way for members of Congress to be able to later on say, if the war goes badly, that they weren't really for the war to begin with. How many members of Congress have you heard who signed who voted for the resolution to use force in Iraq and Afghanistan years later, once those wars were unpopular, saying, well, I never really meant it to happen this way. I was just talking about authorizing the president to use force. The whole idea of the Constitution is that you're compelling Congress to essentially underwrite what the president wants to do. The best war presidents in history have been those who had members of Congress who were criticizing everything that they were doing. And the same thing is true with protests throughout the United States. If you protest against the way a war is being run, you are fulfilling the highest responsibility of American citizenship.
Talking with Michael Beschloss, presidential historian, author of Presidents of War, the epic story from 1807 to modern times. And Robert asks, could your guest discuss the involvement of the CIA in engineering the Gulf of Tonkin, very similar to the Bay of Pigs debacle, in my opinion?
Absolutely, because when Lyndon Johnson said to Americans, we've got to go into a big war in Vietnam because there was this unprovoked attack on an American ship in the Gulf of Tonkin, you know, guess who was doing the provoking? It was us. There were covert operatives that were trying to provoke the North Vietnamese all that summer, as Lyndon Johnson well knew. And so, yes, you know, the CIA and other, you know, other weapons of government who do covert operations were very much a part of what Johnson was trying to do at the time.
And here's Bill, who asks, for many years, the federal government called the Vietnam War a conflict, or even merely a conflict. Is there a difference between conflicts we deem wars? Well, wars by nature were always armed conflicts up until recently with all the technology that has become part of war. But in answer to his question, Michael?
I think war is war. And I think any effort to call it by something else is an effort to make it seem less brutal and at times unnecessary than it has too often been in American history.
And we go to another caller. Roger, that's you. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. You know, I think the reason this country is so easily manipulated into war is because this country has never really experienced the horror of war, not on the scale of Russia or Germany. We've had two oceans, I should say, our two best generals have been the Atlantic and the Pacific. We are so easily manipulated by people. They tap into the latent hate people have in themselves. They can manipulate them against communists. A few years before when we fought World War II, the communists were on our side.
There's an important point in that, I think, Michael Beschloss.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I would even build on that point that a modern president, you know, let's say you had a president who was really unscrupulous and devilish, could fabricate an incident, God forbid, and may it never happen, something that looks like a terrorist attack as an excuse to get America involved in a war. And with modern communications and the speed with which people will emotionally react to this, this could happen at any moment, and it depends on the character of the person who is president of the United States. And I think the question we have to ask is this something that would be beyond Donald Trump in doing?
Well, as long as we're there, I'm interested in finding out what your thoughts are on the fact that people used to have a kind of boilerplate phrasing about, I may not respect the president, but I respect the office of the presidency. But we've found a president now who is probably, not his base notwithstanding, and he has very strong support from his base, passionate support, but many people who find him beyond reasonable expectations of respect. How has that affected the office, do you think?
Well, you know, what is the most basic thing that we ask a president to do? And I think it is make decisions about war and peace, decide when young Americans are going to be sent into harm's way and when they aren't. But something even more important than that, and that is that president is the custodian of nuclear weapons. You know, none of us would say if the Soviet missiles, it's looking pretty Soviet these days, the Russian missiles were flying over the North Pole, that a president should consult Congress. He's going to have the judgment. Do we all feel comfortable that if that terrible moment ever happened, that we could be confident that Donald Trump's judgment about whether to use nuclear weapons or not would protect us?
Well, if there were North Korean missiles, I guess it would be okay because he's fallen in love with Kim Jong-un.
He's fallen in love, yeah. And maybe Saudi too, if there ever were.
Michael, good to have you with us. Congratulations on the book, and appreciate very
Thank
much
you so much,
spending
Michael.
This hour
Love
with
being
us.
With you as always.
And presidential historian, author, again, of Presidents of War. He'll be Thursday at noon at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco and 7 o'clock p.m. at Dominican University in San Rafael with Book Passage. Thank you for being a part of the program, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.